This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to George Runner, who's a California state senator from the Antelope Valley in the 17th Senate District. Well, welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you.
You're one of the two joint authors, along with Senator Deborah Ortiz, of SB 18 and SCA 13. Before we talk about each of them separately, why don't you tell us about the relationship of those two bills and where they are in the process right now?
Well, they both just received the votes to get out of our health committee in the state Senate. So they're on their way to, one is double referred to another committee. The other will go to appropriations now. And so that's where they are in the process. One is a constitutional amendment dealing with some changes in the law applying to Prop 71 that was passed by voters last fall. And the other one is just some additional statute clarifying the issue of multiple egg donation and the issue of informed consent for those who would choose to do that for research purposes.
Do they both deal with conflict of interest issues?
No, only one. That would be the constitutional amendment. Deals with the issue of both conflict of interest and then also the issue of open meetings, making sure that people understand exactly what's taking place within the organization.
So SB 18 has to do with egg donations,
yes.
And SCA 13 has to do with conflict of interest and openness.
Right.
And that's presented as a constitutional amendment, which will, if passed by the legislature, go to the voters.
Correct.
When will it go to the voters?
Right now in California, of course, the governor's talking about a special election this fall.
Right.
If indeed these would be items passed by the legislature by probably the 1st of July, they would be on a fall special election ballot. If not, they would fall at the next time that there's a regular state election, which would actually be next June.
Does the governor need to sign the proposed constitutional amendment before it goes to the voters?
No, it's just between
the legislature and the people.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's sort of the administrative situation of these bills. Let's talk about the substance of it, but even before we do that, let's address this important issue. Proposition 71 provided that its provisions could not be modified by the legislature for 3 years following its passage, and only then by a 70% majority.
Right.
Why was that provision included?
It depends how cynical you want to look at that issue.
Well, look at it from a range of cynicism.
I would say it was put in there with that kind of restriction in order to make sure that the legislature did not involve itself in the activities of those individuals that would be dealing with the dollars from Prop 71.
Okay, well, now the legislature is involving itself. How are you getting around that pretty clear admonition or restriction in the legislation that was passed to modify it?
Well, we're doing it through another constitutional amendment.
Okay.
Typically, what we would do would be that we would actually get involved actually through the issue of statutes.
Right.
That we would actually pass in the legislature. Because of that provision in Prop 71, we have to go the process of actually amending the state constitution in the areas where Prop 71, which was also a state constitutional amendment, was. So that's why we're having to go at it in this way.
Okay, so there are two parts, and the conflict of interest and open meeting and open records, that's where you're going the constitutional amendment route.
Right, because that has actually to do with the operation of the institute in their dealing with the dollars that are coming from the bond sale that are paid for by voters, by the electorate.
Right. Now, how are you able to deal with the egg donation issue by statute?
Because it is a broader application, goes beyond just the issue of the institute and the Prop 71. It is an informed consent. Dealing with multiple egg donation for anybody who's involved in the issue of egg donation for research purposes.
Okay, and in fact, so it's going to touch on the egg donation function and operations of the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee hereinafter, ICOC,
right.
And the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine hereinafter,
right.
The CIRM.
Right.
Those groups will be involved with egg donation, and therefore... But the statute that you're putting forward as SB 18 that regulates that will regulate it for them and for everybody else.
If, for instance, a UC was also doing some work in this area, it would apply to them.
Yes. Are those rules that you're putting in? Obviously, you're legislating them. They're not in place now.
That's correct.
Are there any rules at all on the state level regulating egg donation?
No, there isn't, and that's really the why it is that it's appropriate for it to be addressed.
Okay.
In a broader application than just those funds used for out of Prop 71.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of these about the provisions in the SCA 13 that mm-hmm. have to do with the structure and operation of the ICOC and the CIRM. Among other things, it sets up an audit and audit oversight committee. Who's going to be on that committee? What's its responsibility?
Well, it sets up a requirement for them to actually then go ahead and audit and make that audit. The state auditor is basically involved with that audit.
Right.
And that audit then goes back to the state legislature.
And there are no provisions for that as of now?
Right. That's correct.
Okay. And there's also a requirement for a Citizens Financial Accountability Oversight Committee, which seems to have a procedure for filling its slots almost as complicated as the slots on the ICOC.
Right.
What's that about?
Well, it's all about trying to get the citizens involved with going on. And again, we're early in the legislative process, and I think that what we're trying to do is set up some systems that make sure that the public is involved and aware of what's happening with their tax dollars. And at this point, we've just gone through our first committee. We're going to go actually in the next committee for that particular stop is constitutional amendments. And, I would not assume that some of those issues that are in the current bill actually stay there to the end of the process. What I would want to speak to is the larger issue, which is the idea that says that these are citizens' dollars, and therefore there ought to be more involvement than currently is provided for under the original Prop 71 law.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the idea of the Audit Oversight Committee and Citizens Financial Accountability Oversight Committee, those are ways of implementing your general desire
right.
to have more accountability.
And if the legislature in our discussions and process, finds better ways to do that, we're certainly open to those issues.
Okay. Talk about open meeting laws and the Brown Act and the Keene Acts and
right.
how those don't apply now and how you want
well,
them
right
to.
Well, right now the Institute has a governing board, and there are certain laws that apply to that governing board, but the real working issues, the real decision-making process actually takes place in a multiple of working groups that
right.
are also a part of the Institute.
Right.
Now, at those points, none of those meetings right now have provisions for any open meeting access. So what you have is you have an Institute board that basically, in many cases, will just rubber stamp
right.
The decisions that are made by these working groups. And we just feel like that's a place of access that the people of California should have. I mean, again, this is a $3 billion bond, which actually is going to end up costing the taxpayers more like $6 billion
right.
as it's paid back. And so, we just think that for that reason, citizens ought to have access to what the process is, what the priorities are of those working groups, and they can see how their monies are being spent.
And how do the open records laws also apply to that?
Well, again, that's basically going through what is current law in regards to access of records, the request for those. But more importantly, it's the issue of, for instance, when it is that agendas are sent out, putting items on agenda so
right.
that the public can be aware of what's going to be coming up in the discussion, and then posting meetings when those meetings are going to take place, so that again the public can be there. And again, we're not in many cases like this. Obviously, it's not the general public that just shows up to all these places.
Right.
A lot of this is going to be accountability that's going to be held through the media. And the media has access, and the media goes to those meetings. And that's where it is, and there's a whole host of media out there that specializes in these kinds of sciences. And so that's the group that we believe should have access, because that's where most of the citizens are going to hear about what's going on.
Okay. Now, there have been, I don't know if outcry is too strong a word, there have been issues raised by public groups they're complaining about the lack of openness in the operations of the ICOC, which has itself issued some regulations about this and some statements on
right.
how open it's going to be and what it's going to do about conflict of interest. Have you looked those over, and how satisfied are you that that kind of self-regulation is going to be sufficient and that this bill might not even be necessary?
Well, let me speak to those on two levels. Yes,
right.
we have been reviewing some of those, and certainly some of those are moving in the very right direction. The reality, though, is that we probably wouldn't be satisfied no matter what they chose to do.
Right.
Because the fact is that we believe that they're a public agency, and therefore we're concerned about the fact that a public agency would be self-regulating itself.
Right.
Because what happens with that is, okay, that those are the standards that you've taken today, but what guarantees do we have in the future, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, that those same that a new board group would not want to change those standards?
So in other words, if they make that decision voluntarily on their own behalf, it's subject to revision by them at any time.
Right, which is precisely why it is that we don't like, for instance, the city council do it that way.
Right.
So we're just asking them to come up to that standard and have an outside a standard that they're dealing with, one that is not in their control, and that way we know it's in place. No matter who their board members are and no matter who the legislature is.
Okay, relative to this, and I don't want to interfere with the operations of any courts, would you be able to comment on a lawsuit that's been brought against the ICOC? Or would that be inappropriate?
No, probably not. I mean, I'm aware, and there's a couple, and they've been filed for differing reasons.
Right.
And we don't have an opinion in regards to whether or not, you know, what the strength of those suits are.
Right.
Part of the issue that we believe is we think that by clarifying both open meetings and relationships that they have with conflict of interest laws,
right.
We believe, quite frankly, that the material and the decision-making that comes out of the Institute will actually be less at risk for issues that could come against them in regards to somebody making, some kind of shadow upon a decision that was been made by them for a grant that has been given.
Right. If the state rules are being followed rather than their own internal ones,
right.
then it's more credible.
Right.
Before we go into the conflict of interest provisions in particular, have you heard from either Mr. Klein or the ICOC or on their behalf how they feel about this, whether they're going to testify, that they're going to agree with you, fight you, go along with what you say, or what?
Well, I think officially we heard from some of their representatives as we took testimony the other day in committee.
Right.
They have some representation there in Sacramento who are kind of speaking for them. And I guess what they actually registered was concerns. I don't think they registered in opposition to the bill. I think they have concerns about the bill.
Right.
And I think I could, the summary of that, I believe, is that they believe they should be self-regulated.
Right.
I believe that they would sense that they can kind of work on that standard themselves. And again, we just don't agree with that.
Okay. Let's talk about conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
What are the general principles that you're putting into place here?
Well, again, we just think that there's a standard that ought to be set that says that if a person has financial interest, A, that should be disclosed.
Right.
And on top of that, we believe that if there are certain levels of that financial interest conflict, that the individual should, depending on the size of what their conflict is, not participate at all on the board.
You mean in specific cases, or be on the board at all?
Oh well, it depends again on the size of their conflict. If it's significant enough, we don't believe that they should be on the board nor the working group. We believe that there are plenty of individuals who are well versed in these issues, who can represent the public very well, who do not come with those kinds of financial ties to individuals or companies that could actually get, for instance, the grants.
Well, specifically, Mr. Penhote, who's the vice chair, Dr. Penhote,
right,
is a founder of Chiron, and apparently still has a lot of investments in biotech companies. Is he someone who ought to consider his position there?
Well, I guess at this point I'm not informed well enough to know how that particular company's or what his holdings may be,
right,
in actual conflict with how the grants may go.
Right.
And again, we're not trying to the issue of our legislation isn't focused on any particular individual or known conflict at this time.
Right.
We just believe that what you have to have in place is a standard.
Right.
And then, you know, at that point, you know what it is that you can measure against.
Who's going to be enforcing those standards?
Well, at that point, as a constitutional amendment would be adopted, it would be the state law. So therefore, the attorney general,
okay,
if there's conflict, or DA,
right,
would actually be enforcing that standard. You know, we don't think it's good enough, just for instance, for somebody to just stay off the vote,
right,
or for them to remind themselves, oh, you better not vote on this because of this reason.
Right.
Those are the issues that we believe need to actually have some very specific guidelines. And then people ought to know about the holdings, too,
right,
that individuals have. And again, this is no different than what happens for me as a legislator or for a city council member, for that matter.
Isn't there this general issue, though, that I'd like you to address? Let's say that a member of the ICOC owns stock in one particular biotech company,
mm-hmm.
but not in another one.
Right.
And in a particular a research proposal is going to be implemented by company B.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the whole idea of spending this much money, $3 billion, in this industry going to raise all the ships on that particular sea? Isn't the fact that funding that goes to one biotech company is going to be furthering the careers of everyone from the top to the bottom of that company, and that will generally make it more attractive? I mean, that was pretty much the overarching philosophical justification of Prop 71 in the first place.
Oh, I agree, but the fact is that all may be true, but at the same time, I don't think the point of Prop 71 was that any individual or corporation would inappropriately financially benefit themselves. And in fact, the whole idea of Prop 71 was not only to find these discoveries and see what's available out there, but also to make these available to the general public of California,
okay,
because they are indeed
right.
an investor.
Right, we're going to talk about that, but I guess I just want you to address whether or not the whole industry is so interrelated that it's almost impossible to pull out separate threads of conflict of interest, and that whatever specific rules you set up may not be enough to defeat a kind of self-dealing in general.
Well, I guess it's hard to speak to a theoretical at that point.
Right.
I guess I can speak in general to, we think it's inappropriate for individuals to be involved in dealings where they have personal stake at getting financial benefit.
And you feel that the rules that you're putting in place will ensure that?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on to assisted oocyte production, or AOP, also known as drug injections with powerful hormones to induce hyperovulation.
Right.
What these rules, as I read the legislation, apply, it seems to apply principally to fertility clinics, not to, there didn't seem to be any specific reference to experimentation run by biotech companies or university departments under the auspices of Prop 71 money. Am I right in that?
Well, no, I actually I'm not sure exactly which version of the bill you may have on that.
Right. Well,
there was a previous version of the bill prior to us going to committee.
I think I looked at SB 18 as amended on the California legislative website.
It's pretty specific that it's for egg donation to research purposes.
Oh, okay.
We basically took the fertility issue out.
Oh, okay.
And made it just the issue of egg donation for the purpose of research.
Okay.
And let me tell you the rationale there.
Okay.
Because originally at one point there was two issues. Number one, there was an informed consent,
right,
for the fertility aspect.
That's the stuff I read all about there.
And a ban on the research side.
A ban?
A ban for 3 years, which again...
Oh, right, okay.
I need to understand that sounds radical, but that's actually the law that Canada has adopted.
Right.
Now, what we've done is we've moved away from that to basically specifically dealing with written informed consent on the issue of egg donation for research purposes.
Okay, well, let me change horses.
So that's the extent of what we're doing on that issue right now.
Okay, because as I read it, there were a lot of rules governing informed consent for women who were hyperovulating in fertility clinics for their own purposes.
Again, I'm not sure exactly what version of the bill that is. Let me just speak to it this way.
Okay.
That's no longer the intent.
Well, what we said about 10 minutes ago about that there are no regulations for egg donations or for hyperovulation procedures, are you saying that you're not addressing that now and there still won't be any such?
There is no provision right now in regards to the super on the fertility aspect of it.
Okay, because there were parts of that had to do with the disposition of leftover extra eggs as a result of fertility treatments. That's not being addressed anymore.
The issue, no, the specific issue here is when it is that you have the specific use of those eggs for research purposes.
Okay, well then why don't you talk about...
And the reason for that, the reason for that is that we came to the conclusion, the fact is that there is, there is a personal benefit in the issue that a family goes into when they're going to the issue of superovulation for the issue of creating a child for their family.
Right, for purposes there's of IVF.
There's a reason, there's a risk, they're doing that.
Right.
We see that, we see a pretty bright line between that and then the individual who volunteers to do it for research purposes.
Right. Okay, well, then let me just make that point one more time and then go on to what you've actually talked about.
Okay.
The provisions that I read about talked about informed consent for women who were doing hyperovulation for their own purposes.
Right.
For conceiving a child.
Right.
But it also dealt with the fate of those extra eggs that weren't that may have been hyperovulated but weren't used in the IVF procedure. That's not addressed anymore in your bill, and that will continue not to be regulated then. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So, but what you are doing is setting forth rules for women and doctors who work with them for the hyperovulation for research purposes. What are the general principles that you set forth for in that situation?
Basically, a written informed consent.
And what does that informed consent need to consist of?
It needs to consist of potential risk that studies have shown in regards to women's health, susceptible to ovarian cancer, those kinds of issues we believe are important issues for the individual to go into, knowing that when they move into the issue of basically being a subject of research.
Right. Okay. I did an interview earlier this week with Betty Poirier, who's a Massachusetts state representative, and she's a Republican, and which is a small minority of the Massachusetts legislature. She wrote an op-ed piece that appeared this Monday, and she lists a number of risks, including death, respiratory or cardiac arrest, brain damage, paraplegia, paralysis, and it goes on for a while here, that are possible short-term risks with hyperovulation, and the fact that there's no information yet really about what the long-term risks are, because this hasn't been going on for a long time. How gruesome or specific do you expect, or are you requiring that these informed consent forms be to convince women about the realities of what they're about to undergo?
Well, again, I think we're going to have to. We right now are very early in our legislative process. We're just right now approaching the issue of the informed consent aspect of it.
Right.
I think at some point, as we go through this process, we're going to have to delineate out exactly to what level that is. And of course, the other issue, it's a very changing issue.
Right.
You know, what we know as risk today may be different than what it is 3 years from now.
One way or another. I mean, either higher or lower.
Correct. That's correct. And so, you know, we have to make it flexible enough to reflect what current science indicates.
Okay.
That's our intention. You know, one of the issues I think we want to come back to, too, and one of the reasons why we think this is an appropriate discussion to have is because when we were dealing with Prop 71, the voters were dealing with it, there wasn't a lot of discussion of this issue.
That's right.
The assumption was that there was enough of this material already around that we would be using existing material.
Well, specifically what you're talking about are frozen embryos left over from IVF treatments.
Right. And so there was not a lot of discussion of this kind of the science.
Right.
And that's another reason why we think it's inappropriate for a public discussion now and also for a statute and informed consent.
Okay, I'd like to have a little bit of that discussion right now if we could. The leftover embryos from IVF are, of course, the genetic product of the individuals who created them. There was a very good show on PBS a day or two ago, Robert Krowich's new show, talking about the use of cloning as a way of producing embryos that the stem cells of which would be known to have come from individuals with known disease conditions in order to study those disease conditions. Now, those obviously cannot be taken from, unless, of course, it turns out that the pure form of a person with that disease can only come from somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And that necessarily requires a human egg mm-hmm. to do that. Now, the Representative Poirier in Massachusetts cited a researcher who said that it might be necessary to, in order to provide, say, 1.7 million therapies per year, a minimum of 5 to 8 million human eggs per
right.
year.
Right.
Now, where is it the expectation of the legislators where those are going to come from?
Well,
just in California, the United States, the whole world, and to what extent are you addressing the issue of who's going to be, and that's what we want to get into here for this point, the compensation for these women
right.
who are doing this, apart from the risks they're undertaking. Obviously, the other half of the risk, they're going to do a risk-benefit analysis. And the risks we've talked about, the benefits, you're also excluding paying them
right.
as such, aren't you?
Yes,
and,
we are.
What's the story on that?
Well, we don't believe, for instance, that, again, that we should be going out, and we think there could be very much at-risk populations
right.
who end up weighing off, for instance, the potential risk if somebody says, hey, I'll give you X amount of dollars
right.
or whatever. And of course, you can get even more macabre than that. You could be dealing with, you know, targeting, you know, low-income areas, you know, third-world countries.
Right.
You know, and you trade off a transistor radio.
Right. Are there are there provisions or an Internet Wi-Fi phone, I guess by now it would be. But, right.
And that's why we think the payment issue is important to have to set that standard.
Okay, what is the standard on the payment issue?
Well, we just say they can't. It's got to be for reimbursed costs.
And what costs are those
and again,
exactly?
Again, that's one of the issues that we're going to be dealing with
right.
because I think there's been a lot of abuse of that issue.
Right.
So I think one of the issues we're going to have to come down to is define what reimbursed cost is. Because we just don't think, again, people should be out there actively making money and then basically trading off risk for a dollar exchange.
Right.
Particularly if you take, you know, a population who might be not able to make a clear weighing of the risk that they're taking because they may be so dependent or misled in regards to the exchange that they're getting.
Okay, well,
those are issues that I think are very valid. And quite frankly, those are the kinds of things that, and why we think it's an important discussion to have as we move through the legislature, because those are discussions that the population of California never had
right.
when we were dealing with the voting on Prop 71. Prop 71, when people were voting on it, was, hey, how do we help people who are in wheelchairs walk?
Right.
And how do we help people who are, you know, who have certain diseases be able to be free for those diseases? We really didn't talk about some of the other sides of what the impact could be as we move through the science.
We might want to have to add to Bismarck's remark that people don't like to see how laws or sausages are made. They don't want to see how stem cells are made either.
Well, you know, I've not seen that particular piece that you were dealing with there, and I'd be very, I mean, hopefully, man, maybe after
I'll give you the link to it, sure.
If you could do that, that'd be great, because that's really a fascinating issue, and it is certainly where the debate is. And you know, this is kind of what we're concerned about. We're concerned that somehow people are so fixated on the kind of the healing aspect
right.
that we are kind of diverting ourselves or not fully exposing everybody to some of the other issues and roadblocks that we might want to just have in place, or even just checkpoints to make sure that we don't go, you know, head over heels for something, but yet realize that in that process we create a whole another group of victims. You know, getting toward this goal out there.
Yes, you've exactly touched on what I was going to call a sort of law of conservation of suffering. Because let's assume that the science all works out, but in order to get the eggs to make this work, it's necessary to subject millions of women to untested biochemical
right.
experiments that could create as much suffering on their part as is going to be relieved in the parts of the people who benefit from the stem cell research.
And we as a society haven't. I mean, we don't. When it comes to the issue of some of the ethic discussions that we have, when it comes to the issue of our bodies and science, we haven't come to the point to where we've stated that the ends always justifies the means.
Right.
We there might be lots of discoveries that are available if we chose to do some things.
Right.
That right now we have some ethical barriers for.
Okay, let me talk about some economic barriers or elements and dynamics here. There are essentially two provisions in what you're doing here to prevent a kind of exploitation of women locally or globally. One is to say that women can't be rewarded or financially incentivized to do this? And secondly, you say that there can't be trade in eggs. There can't be brokerage or resale or those issues. That sounds to me like you're in trying to control something for which there's a demand, and by saying you can't pay people for it and you can't make money out of it, that looks like a natural precursor to creating a black market in something like this, so that if you've prohibited this, someone's going to say, you know, it's a valuable commodity, we're going to try to get it under the table somehow. The stories that I've been putting up on the California Politics Today site about these issues have been getting ads from Google about egg donations and offering women $2,000-$3,000 or more for their eggs.
Well, you remember there's a little difference in regards to this particular egg donation or the issue of hyperovulation versus the issue of what we see when for instance somebody is donating an egg for implantation.
That's because someone really wants them to use it to have a baby.
And also then you know, I mean, unfortunately, you can get in some really bizarre stuff. Where all of a sudden somebody's looking for somebody of X IQ, you go to this university.
Right.
You know, because
so you have a market there, and you've got this graduate
genetic,
and this.
There's somehow this idea that there's the genetics of that particular donor is going to produce an offspring that has certain abilities.
Right.
That's different than the whole issue that we have when we talk about the issue of superovulation, because at that point we're no longer they're not concerned about the particular
because you're taking out the nucleus
of that egg, because they're going to be replacing that.
This becomes a commodity, except for the quality of the mitochondrial DNA, which may have some aspect to it,
remains. We're quickly leaving my knowledge.
Okay, but in any case, no, you're right, because people who want to get an egg from a woman who's a graduate of a prestigious private university versus any old one, in fact, the genetic material that made her of that quality is going to be denucleated. It's going to be pulled out, and it's not going to be used for that.
Which is why under the idea of egg harvesting, particularly at risk will be, I believe, the poor communities, people who could be targeted with financial interests, because they're not looking for an individual of certain standard. They're looking for anybody who will, you know, step up to the plate and maybe earn a few bucks.
Right. Anyone's egg is as good as anyone else's when you've taken the nucleus
out.
That's
correct. That's what makes this discussion and this issue one that we think is appropriate for the legislature to weigh in and for the public to have a discussion.
Okay, and again, the way it's formulated now, do you think that will be adequate? And can California legislate over behavior if so many things are outsourced to India and China these days? Those are obvious places where people who want to get 100,000 or a million eggs are going to go. Can California law regulate what people do in India and China?
No, it can't. But what we can regulate is what the standard is for us. And again, this is where, you know, it has, and again, this is a broader standard than just the issue of those who will be using Prop 71 money.
Right.
But the fact is, if indeed somebody is involved with Prop 71 money and they are now going outside of what the California state law is, they certainly are at risk.
At risk for a prosecution.
Right.
Because one of the other functions of Prop 71 was to jumpstart biotechnology research within California.
Right.
But presumably, it's going to be possible for these tests if there are lab workers who are doing. Let's say denucleation becomes an assembly line process, and it's going to be done hundreds of thousands of times a year, and it requires a certain amount of human intervention. Aren't those California biotech companies going to want to have that done in India or China at a quarter of the rate it would cost them to do it here in California?
Well, again, what we would suggest is that, you got to remember, there are countries like Canada who've actually put a moratorium on it.
Right.
So, I mean, where we're going is not even as far as some other places have gone.
Right.
Just putting a whole moratorium on the issue.
Right.
We're just dealing with informed consent at that point.
Right. But the point I wanted to focus on was the global nature of this and the ability of a California law to control what goes on
Well, there's all kinds of things that go on in different places of the world
right.
that we don't allow in California, and so we don't let our standard cannot be to the lowest worldwide standard.
Right.
I mean, the bottom line is if indeed somebody goes and does that process and does something and therefore breaks California law,
right.
they will be prosecuted
right.
by California
but
law.
But what I'm asking is whether under what you're proposing as California law, California corporations will be prohibited from violating these standards if they do it in India or China. And recruit the women, hyperovulate them, pay them, give them a transistor radio, as you said,
right.
And then do the denucleation in India,
yeah.
and do all
I'm
that.
Not, I'm not the legal expert on
right.
this, but I would assume that if they're doing that, and then they bring whatever material they have that they produce with that
right.
to California,
well, yes.
that is indeed. Not allowed under California law.
But they can do all the research. They can do all the research in India, and then just
well,
bring
I,
back.
Again, I can't.
Okay.
You know, we can't control what somebody does
okay.
in another country.
Okay.
Now I can be pretty clear, and that is if indeed a company is doing those kinds of things.
Right.
And at the same time, they're asking California taxpayers for money.
Right.
And their research is being paid for them.
Right.
I think they're going to be suspect then when it comes to the issue of the grants available for them for their research.
Okay. All right. Let's sort of...
We're just past a half hour. So
okay. We just have one more big issue here.
Okay.
We'll work on that. That has to do with the money and the accessibility of these treatments once they're available. What are the provisions that you're making here to ensure that low-income residents in California are able to access these hypothetical
okay.
Treatments?
Well, again, we're feeling. Well, I mean, we basically look at this as if you're a joint investor
right.
in somebody's science experiment.
Right.
And if you were, then you would get the benefit of that.
Right.
We believe that California citizens deserve the benefit on two levels. Number one, they deserve the financial benefit.
Right.
And so as these breakthroughs are made and as these actually develop into medicines, therapies that are going to be successful, and they have a market value, we believe California should receive back some of those royalties for that. The taxpayers should.
And at what level? At what percentage?
That's an issue of that's an issue that has to be worked out and debated, and we're trying to get
okay,
clarifying language.
But right,
generally speaking, we believe that we are a partner with these folks that are doing that research, and so
right.
California deserves that. The other issue we believe is that if these therapies are available, and breakthroughs. And let's say that they are fairly expensive and not available through a lot of different regular kinds of payments that we would make through Medi-Cal, those kind of programs.
Right.
We would believe that they should be made available in some way to California's insured, that we as taxpayers insure
right.
in that way. And so we need to develop some kind of a system that provides those benefits to those individuals. We don't think, for instance, the poor individual who for instance, is, as a discovery is made dealing with some kind of a, an Alzheimer's, for instance, a therapy,
right.
should not have access to that. And quite frankly, the issue that opens up this door is the fact that you're using taxpayers' money on this deal.
Right. So I understand that you want to make sure that lower income people have access to it. What about middle income people who can't just write a check for $80,000 for a month's treatment, but aren't covered by insurance?
Well, we would believe all Californians. So the issue is probably the insured versus the uninsured,
right.
or the state insured individual. So
what about people outside of California? Are there any restrictions there? Can these companies then charge whatever the market will bear
yes.
in Nevada?
That's correct.
Or any place else
That's
in the
correct.
World, they can make that much money.
That's
okay.
correct.
Let's talk a little bit about the politics of. Some of the language used here says that the state ought to recoup an amount commensurate with its role in the development
right.
of the clinical treatments. Isn't the state 100% responsible for funding them? Shouldn't it have a 100% share?
No,
in
I
the
don't
profits?
Think. No, they're not 100%. I mean, we are 100% of the
investor
of the Prop 71 side of it.
Right.
But the assumption is that these grants will be going to groups that are also have dollars and other monies that they are using for this therapy too.
Okay, so you mean if there's a project that's 50% funded by Prop 71 and 50% funded by other ones, that the state ought to get 50% of the profits?
So, I mean, the idea is that we are a partner,
right?
And therefore we should get a fair value for what it is that we are coming into the deal with.
What about in cases where 100% of the funding comes from the state? From the ICOC with state money.
Well, then the state should have get a bigger share of that part.
100%?
I don't. Again, that's an issue that I think we have to work through,
okay.
And that has to be negotiated. But the point is that the state has to get its fair share.
Okay. Let's just wrap up by talking about the politics of this.
Yes.
Is anyone opposed to your bills here?
Well, so far we came out of committee with 100% support, both Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
You know, I guess we'll have to see from there. We have no list of opposition. You know, there are some groups who have registered concerns, such as the Institute,
right?
And some of the companies that will benefit from these grants. But right now, I have not talked to, and I don't think Senator Ortiz has heard from any particular legislator who says, "Hey, I have a problem with this."
Okay. I was just reading a few minutes before I started talking to you that Senators Feinstein, Specter, Kennedy, and Hatch are hatching, if you'll pardon the expression, a human cloning ban and Stem Cell Research Protection Act of 2005 on the federal level, addressing some of these same issues.
I saw that, and that's to kind of deal with the fact where the president's position is on stem cell research when it comes to embryonic.
And do you see that as affecting the California situation, or the California situation affecting the national debate on that at all?
I'm sure they're interwoven in terms of the issue. And the fact is that there's federal money that cannot be mixed with state money now as a result of the federal ban in certain kinds of therapies. So yeah, there is. I couldn't tell you right now precisely where that is and what that line is. But you know, I think at this point the president's made himself pretty clear as to where his position is.
Okay, let me just wrap up with one sort of final bonus question.
Okay,
everyone seems to be opposed to human reproductive cloning.
Yes.
Could you address the kind of paradoxical issue of why it should be that allowing a cloned embryo created by somatic cell nuclear transfer to grow to term is morally worse than destroying the
you know,
cell?
I'm not the one, because quite frankly, I'm in this weird position where I oppose Prop 71 under my own moral conviction.
Right.
So personally,
right.
I have a difficulty with that. I cannot draw that bright line.
Right.
You know, So I'm the wrong person to draw that line. What I'm dealing with is now the fact that you've got taxpayers' money already involved with this, so we're dealing on the public policy side of that, not on the moral dilemma that I believe that we have as a broader discussion
okay.
on this issue.
Good. I want to thank you for having this discussion with us. And
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And can I...
Hello?
Are you recording still?
I am, but I'll stop as soon as I say a formal goodbye, and
okay.
thank you for talking to us today on California Politics Today.
Okay, thank you.